Good evening. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all on behalf of the editorial committee of the Modern Law Review to this lecture in honour of our founding editor, Lord Chorley of Kendal. Chorley was teaching commercial law here in the 1930s, a moment seen by some as one of the golden ages of the school, when he and a group of London colleagues, including Jim Gower, who I can see in the audience this afternoon, started the Modern Law Review in 1937. Chorley continued as general editor until 1971 and was active on the editorial committee until his death late in 1977. This lecture series was founded during his life, and he presided over and I think enjoyed the early lectures in the series. This 24th lecture in the series also falls in the school's centenary year. And for this special occasion, we're delighted to welcome Professor Roberto Unger as our lecturer. Roberto Unger's work is so widely known and admired that any elaborate introduction from me is quite unnecessary. He studied law first in his native Brazil and then at Harvard Law School, where he's since taught. From his earliest books, Knowledge and Politics and Law in Modern Society, published in 1975 and 1976 respectively, Unger has speculated about the nature of society and of law with a freedom and sweep unprecedented in Anglo-American law schools in recent times. And he's done so from a vantage point of his bridging position between the civilian and the common law worlds. At the time Unger became a law teacher, legal scholars were, on the whole, a fairly specialized, introspective breed who drew rather parsimoniously and haltingly on other disciplines in their professional writings. In contrast, from the very start of his work, Unger engaged with a wide range of the social sciences. I think it's no exaggeration to say that his writings have liberated generations of his colleagues and have changed their conception of what legal scholarship might be. If law schools like this one here at LSE and journals like the Modern Law Review are different places from what they were at the beginning of the 1960s, Roberto Unger bears considerable responsibility for that. Unger has also energetically combined teaching and writing with active participation in a range of social and political projects in Brazil. So the man of theory and the man of action are combined here. Now, I realized talking to him this afternoon with shock and remorse that this is the first lecture Professor Unger has given at the school. But I'm delighted that a Chorley lecture and the school's centenary are providing the occasion to put this right. Roberto Unger will speak this evening on legal analysis as institutional imagination.
Thank you. From the time of its foundation, the London School of Economics has been committed to the idea that there is no real conflict between the perspective of the searcher for insight into the truth about society and the perspective of the committed critic and reformer. The founders of the school gambled their work on the belief that these two commitments can both be fulfilled when we put the contemporary institutions of society in their place, by understanding them and judging them from the perspective of unrealized and suppressed transformative opportunity. Today, we can keep this freedom-giving and superstition-subverting idea alive. Only if we recast legal analysis and political economy into practices of institutional imagination. With the aid of this reformed practice of legal and economic study, we can rethink the institutional forms of representative democracies, of market economies, and of free civil societies. We can breathe new life and new meaning into the democratic project. My central theme today is the discussion of legal analysis as a way of imagining the alternative presents and the alternative futures of society. The underlying premise is that we cannot sensibly ask of legal analysis what it inherently or essentially is. We can ask only in what form have we received it, and what should we turn it into. My talk will develop in three steps. First, I want to describe a set of political and intellectual opportunities, suggesting how they may reinforce each other. The central idea is that the democratic project today can advance only by transgressing the boundaries of the received and established institutional settlement. And that in this work of transgression, it requires the help of a revised practice of legal analysis and of economic thought. In the second stage of my argument, I propose to criticize the emerging canonical style of legal analysis, the one that wants to describe law as the expression of connected policies and principles. I shall criticize this rationalistic legal analysis for placing the established institutional settlement beyond the reach of effective criticism and challenge. And I shall propose to put in its place a practice of legal analysis that is focused on the hidden diversity and the multiple possibility of our institutional structure. In the third and final stage of my argument, I shall suggest how this revised practice of legal analysis can intervene in some of the major contemporary political economic debates, such as the debate about the reorganization of firms, or the debate throughout the world about the alternatives to a neoliberal political economy. I begin then with the description of the political and intellectual opportunities. The focus of ideological conflict in the world is shifting. The old contest between statism and privatism is dying and is in the process of being replaced by a new conflict among the alternative institutionalized forms of economic and political pluralism. This conflict is more alive today in the developing countries, as they fail in their efforts to imitate and to import the political and economic institutions of the rich countries. By their failures, they are propelled into an involuntary institutional experimentalism, illustrating in the realm of politics rather than in that of psychology, Piaget's maxim that to imitate is to invent. And this involuntary institutional experimentalism in the poor countries sheds light on the suppressed possibilities of transformation in the rich countries. Thus, the whole world is brought together into a single structure of debate and possibility, organized according to the Wittgensteinian metaphor of the rope. A single rope, although none of its many strands runs from end to end. The significance of this shift in the focus of ideological conflict in the world is concealed today by the influence of an idea about convergence. With the collapse of communism in the Second World and the discrediting of nationalist populist political economies in the Third World, it seems we all know where we're going. Thus emerges the conception of a convergence worldwide toward best available institutional practices. And this idea of convergence is, as it were, an interlude or a regression in the characteristic struggle of modern social thought to free itself from all forms of evolutionary determinism. The main placeholder for this idea of convergence in contemporary debates has become a liberalized and conservative version of social democratic beliefs, which now threatens to become the dead center of gravity of Western politics. A characteristic tenet of this view is that we should continue to be committed to welfare and to investment in people. Another is that we should rid the existing forms of a market economy of their excesses of oligopoly and corporatism, while promoting participation from the bottom up by people in the decisions that influence their everyday lives. But a third idea shaping the range of these other two ideas is skepticism about the range of institutional alternatives and rejection of all large projects of social reconstruction. The outer limit of the institutional imagination of this political program is an idea about partnership between government and business that subverts neither the inherited legal form of the property regime nor the established legal form of the state and of its relation to civil society. Today, the test, the limit, the boundary for this idea of convergence, which suppresses the emergence of the new conflicts of alternative pluralisms, is the worldwide division in each major national economy between vanguard and rearguard. By the vanguard sector of each national economy, I mean not just the forms of production that count on more resources and more knowledge, but also the forms of production in which production comes to resemble learning. The firm becomes a school, and the process of work a permanent experimentalism. In the traditional right-wing and left-wing views of the world economy, production was distributed throughout the world on a hierarchical principle. The advanced forms of production in the rich countries and the more primitive forms of production in the poor countries. The most important fact about the new form of the world economy is that this hierarchical differentiation is being replaced. The vanguardist forms of production can now be undertaken all over the world. And the driving force of the new world economy is the network of these vanguards, pushing one another forward. The mobility of capital around the world is just a sideshow in the service of this network of vanguards. But the network draws sustenance from the unequal treatment of capital and labor. The architects and agents of the new world economy believe that capital should be free to roam around the world, while labor should remain imprisoned within the nation state or within blocks of relatively homogeneous nation states. This oppressive and unsustainable system they call global economic freedom. The division between vanguard and rearguard is becoming the organizing principle of each national economy. And we can find it in the following four typical forms. In the rich countries, as in Sweden, it may be compensated and concealed by the operations of an inclusive and redistributive welfare state. In the rich countries, as in the United States, it may appear in its crudest form without this compensation of the redistributive welfare state. In the poor countries, as in India, it may be moderated not by the universalistic and redistributive welfare state, but by the politically and socially supported diffusion of small-scale property. And finally, in the poor countries, as in Mexico or in Brazil, it may once again appear unqualified because the pro forma commitment to social redistribution is left without effective content. Now, the basic problem is that the two existing forms of moderation of this dualism, of this division between the advanced and the backward, the vanguard and the rear guard, the universalistic redistributive welfare state on one side and the diffusion of small-scale property on the other, both lack an organic connection to the logic of production and of growth, and therefore appear in the end as a mere burden upon the material progress of society. Now, the fundamental structural question is this. Can this division between vanguard and rearguard, be undermined and surpassed, or can it be merely moderated and qualified? The trajectory of alternative pluralisms, of the evolution of the democratic project beyond its present institutional boundaries, lies in the challenge within each national economy and within the world economy as a whole. to this system of dualistic divisions. To challenge this structure, we need a vision and a method. The most powerful vision at our disposal is the democratic project itself. I interpret the democratic project as the combination of two hopes. First, there is a hope of an overlap between the institutional conditions for the material progress of society and the institutional conditions for the emancipation of the individual from entrenched division and hierarchy. The central problem of economic growth or of material progress generally lies in the relation between cooperation and innovation. Innovation requires cooperation, yet innovation threatens cooperation because it threatens to destabilize the concrete social relations and expectations in which every real cooperative system is embedded. The question is, what institutional form of cooperation is more hospitable to the logic of material progress, which is the logic of permanent innovation? And because this development in the institutional form of material progress requires freedom of recombination and the convergence of production and of learning, the Democrat hopes that there may be not a predestined convergence between material progress and individual emancipation, but the possibility of an overlap between the conditions for their advancement. The second hope of the Democrat is that this development of the democratic project through institutional experimentalism can connect with the interests and hopes of the masses of ordinary people. There are always two sets of strategies for the defense of a collective or class interest. One set that is conservative and exclusive, taking the present positions and rivalries as given, and another set that is transformative and solidaristic. The Democrat hopes that the advance of the democratic project can connect with the solidaristic and transformative forms of the defense of popular interests. If the democratic project is the vision that can animate this institutional experimentalism, the method lies in the combination of two sets of conceptual moves. First, in the realm of social and historical explanation and understanding, we need a practice of social science that, unlike the conservative positivist social sciences, recognizes the shaping influence of fundamental institutions and beliefs. But that, unlike the great deterministic theories of the past, such as Marxism, affirms the replaceable, ramshackle, contingent character of these formative structures. At the same time, the second conceptual move in the realm of normative argument is to recognize that there is an internal or dialectical relation between thinking about interests or ideals and thinking about institutions or practices. Our thinking about institutions or practices is not just like the design of social engineering, a technical afterthought. to the statement of our ideals and the definition of our interests. Rather, we think out the content of our interests and our ideals by exploring their possible institutional forms. Two hopes, two moves, and also two disciplines. The most important bearers of this vision and of this message would be a revised practice of political economy and of legal analysis. Recasting political economy and legal analysis as disciplines of the institutional imagination. With this, I turn to the second part of my argument, the discussion of legal analysis and of its transformative possibilities. There is now developing in the world a contest between two styles of legal thought, two modes of legal culture. On one side, many legal cultures remain entangled in practices of low-level analogy. In a historical disorganized particularism, this low-level practice of analogy, this surrender of the imagination of law to historical accident and precedent, often draws nourishment from the association of analogy with the idea of an imminent logic of social life. The law working itself pure, revealing through these countless judgments of analogical distinction and comparison the hidden logic of social coordination. On the other side in this contest stands the practice of rational reconstruction in law. The view that each part of law should be understood and represented as the expression of connected policies and principles, of impersonal ideals of welfare or of right, so that the law on this second view of rational reconstruction is a flawed version of an intelligible and defensible plan of social life. One that the jurists after the fact are able to reveal, and in the name of which they, the jurists, are able to improve the law in the interests of the people who most need help, who are most likely to have lost out in the conflicts of majoritarian mass politics. This practice of rational reconstruction in law, headquartered today in the United States, exercises increasing influence throughout the world. For example, it penetrates the civil law countries, although it penetrates them unevenly. In those civil law countries where, as in France, codification was viewed as a way of taming the anti-democratic power of the jurists, there is still more resistance today to the method of rational reconstruction. But in those other countries like Germany, where codification was more viewed as a summation of juristic insight, the road to the reception of this method of rational reconstruction is open. A common premise of both these sets of views and methods is that the central question for the legal theorist is how should judges decide cases? And the judge is the paradigmatic figure of legal thought. Now, before criticizing this method of rational reconstruction as the acceptable sequel to the low-level particularistic or analogical form of legal culture, I want to suggest a view of the genius of contemporary law, of what is most strikingly original and distinctive in contemporary law and legal thought. 19th century legal science was organized around the contrast between real, hard, distributively neutral law, especially the basic categories of private law, and soft, fake, politicized, redistributive law. The central idea of that legal science was that we could sustain a scheme of freedom by clinging to a certain system of rights, private and public. By contrast, the genius of contemporary law lies in its recognition of the centrality of a problem of the effective enjoyment of rights. Rights in their real exercise depend upon conditions that are empirical and defeasible. And the jurist in this new world of legal culture must be concerned with the ability effectively to exercise the promised rights. From this central concern with the effective enjoyment of rights emerges the organizing principle of contemporary law. One branch of law after another is organized as a dialectic between the rules and rights of choice and the rules and rights that supposedly guarantee the effective conditions of individual and collective self-determination. So, for example, contract in the employment relation complemented by collective bargaining law and by legal regulation of labor. And more generally, on a larger plane, the whole system of private law is in a dialectical relation with a system of guaranteed welfare rights, relatively immune to market instability, that are supposed to help render effective the enjoyment of those private rights. Now, if the great accomplishment of 20th century law was to have brought to the forefront this problem of the effective enjoyment of rights, its great failure, the great riddle in its evolution, is why this idea should remain truncated, why its development should be arrested. From the idea of the effective enjoyment of rights, there should follow, so it seems, a recognition of the diversity of possible institutional forms of a free society. There is always more than one way plausibly to represent the conditions for the effective enjoyment of certain rights. And for whatever way of representing those conditions we accept, there will always be more than one way plausibly to advance through institutional reconstruction the fulfillment of those conditions. But contemporary law and legal thought has stopped it has reached this moment of recognition of the centrality of the problem of enjoyment, while failing to go on to the next step of the exploration of possible diversity. And it has failed in part, so I want to argue, because it has come under the spell of a conception of rational reconstruction in law that immunizes the institutional structure of society against effective criticism and challenge. This truncation, this arrested development in the evolution of law and legal thought helps explain another mystery in the history of contemporary political and social ideas. No achievement of 19th century and early 20th century legal analysis was more important. Then the subversion in the legal understanding of the market of the notion of a natural form of property rights. Property was dissolved into a system of relations and its contingency recognized. The tendency of all of modern legal thought is to subvert institutional fetishism in every domain of social life. The equation of abstract conceptions of political democracy or of market economy or a free civil society with a particular and contingent set of institutional arrangements. Yet this institutional fetishism attacked in the realm of legal thought survives to occupy a central place in economics and in liberal political theory. And it continues to occupy that place because legal thought has failed to carry out the second step of the revolution that it began, when it focused on the centrality of the problem of effective enjoyment of rights. Now, my thesis about legal analysis, in a nutshell, is this. The method of rational reconstruction, the method of representing law as the expression of connected policies and principles, as a flawed approximation to an intelligible and defensible plan of social life, should be rejected. It should be rejected first because it fails to deliver the rationality that it promises. But more importantly, it should be rejected because it is responsible for this truncation of the development of the central idea of the distinctive genius of contemporary law. The development of the idea of the effective enjoyment of rights into the recognition of institutional diversity and possibility. In so helping to truncate the development of legal thought, this method of rational reconstruction also preempts the imaginative space that should be occupied by a practice of legal thought that is able to act as the assistant to the institutional imagination of society about its alternative possible futures. Consider the main ways of understanding the animating motive of this practice of rationalizing legal analysis. The practice of representing law as the expression of connected policy and principle. First, it may rely upon an intellectual superstition, a prejudice against analogy. By analogy, I mean the family of methods of judgment and discourse that work out a dialectical relation between the attribution of purpose and the classification of typical situations, that rely in this attribution of purpose upon an open-ended set of real human interests, and that refuse to ascend the ladder of conceptual ascent toward higher levels of abstraction and system. Now, why should we suppose that these methods of analogy are simply the inchoate and confused first step in the construction of abstract, axiomatic, systematic forms of discourse? They are, after all, at least as entrenched in our ordinary practices and interests as these rival rationalistic methods, and especially entrenched in the understanding that people have of one another, since knowledge of the other and of oneself is analogical. If the method of analogy could be suppressed, the consequence would be to dehumanize law, one method for rules and another for people. Once we put aside this simple prejudice against analogy, another view of the point of the method of rational reconstruction emerges. On this second view, the method of rational reconstruction is what we need to uphold the rule of law in a regime of rights. It is the indispensable antidote to arbitrariness in legal thought. Now, to evaluate this claim, we have to understand that the central problem in the method of rational reconstruction in law is the effort to reconcile a prospective and a retrospective genealogy of law. Before the fact, law looks like a matter of conflict among many different interests and visions. After the fact, in the hands of the jurists, it is made to look as if it were the development of a plan, of a rational scheme. And this problem of the relation between the prospective and the retrospective genealogies, which may be aggravated in statutory law, exists even with respect to judge-made law. For the question is whether the judge sees his predecessors as partners in this effort to make the law pure, or as the representatives of factional interests and ideals. In the method of rational reconstruction, the jurist must claim that some part of this rational scheme is already there in the legal material waiting to be revealed. But if he says all of it is there, no one would believe him. So he must say only some of it is there. And some of it, it is his responsibility to add. In the performance of his role in a democracy of improving the law, of making it better by making it seem better than it is. Now, there must not be too much of a divergence between these two genealogies, the prospective and the retrospective, or else legal thought would be both mystification and usurpation. The basic intellectual condition for the approximation of these two genealogies of law, law before the fact and law after the fact, is that we imagine that under the confusion and conflict of history and politics, There is some scheme developing. The whole history of modern social thought is the history of an apostasy from faith in such a scheme. But if it existed, its consequence would be to impoverish the content of democracy. If democracy means that we make rather than receive the terms of social life. Right-wing Hegelianism and scorn for the people. The worship of the history-making victors and the distrust of popular self-government are the two dirty little secrets of contemporary legal theory. Their management or their suppression generates the characteristic forms of arbitrariness. Pretending the scheme is already there or playing fast and loose with the scheme in order to make it fit the received legal material. Once we lose faith in this idea that the method of rational reconstruction is required, by the rule of law, the regime of rights, we may come to a third conception of its purpose. That it serves a distinct political project, the project of a pessimistic progressive reformism. The jurist can change the structure of things, but he can make things better for the people who most need help. The groups most likely to have lost out. In the political conflicts over lawmaking. Thus, the method of rational reconstruction in law may be seen by analogy to an institutionally conservative social democracy. One that renounces challenges to the institutional structure of production and exchange, and then attempts to compensate for the unequalizing operations of the economy through retrospective tax and transfer. Now, the most important lesson of contemporary policy debates in economics is that policy debates come to nothing and mean nothing if the whole institutional background has to be taken as given. And the most important lesson of this pessimistic progressive reformism in law is that it not only fails to deliver much help to the people who most need its help, but that in the process it pays too high a price. The price of helping to insulate the institutional order of society against the critical imagination and the reconstructive effort. Thus, the characteristic campaigns of rational reconstruction in the United States, for example, the development of a doctrine of substantive equal protection under the American Constitution, are least likely to benefit the members, for example, of the black underclass rather than the black bourgeoisie or even the black organized working class. They are least likely to reach the institutional or structural causes of exclusion and marginalization, and most likely to reproduce a relation between a vanguard of legal notables and an infantilized people. They may be most effective when there is a connection between reform from above and movement from below. But there is nothing in the theory and practice of this legal progressivism that relativizes its work to this special circumstance. So then my central suggestion about legal analysis is this. we should divide, we should bifurcate its work. The problem of adjudication should be seen as a special problem, rather than as the commanding work of legal thought. We should have a deflationary view of legal analysis in an adjudicative context. And another practice of legal analysis, directed not to the judge or to the technocrat or the notable standing in the imaginary position of a judge, but to the citizenry, informing the conversation, the public conversation in a democracy about its future. In the adjudicative context, you can imagine a method of analysis that begins with the deflationary practice of analogy, but with three sets of corrections and qualifications. First, the practice of this low-level literalist and analogical method should be severed from any association with the belief in an immanent logic of social life. Second, there should be a candid acknowledgement of the need for two sets of limiting exceptions. The micro-exceptionalism of equitable adjustment, when there is a localized divergence between moral expectation and legal result without structural consequence. And the macro-exceptionalism of judicial statecraft, when the political branches are inhibited in an undertaking that seems to enjoy broad popular support, and the judges are willing to gamble that their transformative breakthrough will be sustained in politics. But third, we also need altogether another form of intervention directed to those forms of subjugation or exclusion that are both structural and episodic. The American practice of structural injunctions or complex enforcement, with its collective litigants, its method of causal inquiry, and its practice of reorganizing particular institutions, is a forerunner of such a procedure. The problem is that there is no branch of government in the contemporary state that, by virtue of practical capability or political legitimacy, is well designed and well equipped to carry out this work of structural but episodic intervention. If the work is to be done generally through society, rather than just with respect to marginal social institutions, it requires a new institutional agent. And what then about legal analysis in the other larger setting of the public conversations in a democracy? I imagine a form of legal analysis as mapping and criticism. The first moment, the moment of mapping, is a moment in which, free from the compulsion to make everything fit into large and coherent schemes, the characteristic compulsion of the method of rational reconstruction, we explore the suppressed diversity and conflict and contradiction of the actual legal material. As possible starting points for alternative trajectories of institutional development. So, for example, by this method of mapping, we would come to discover that the simple form of the unified property right is surrounded in contemporary economies by a vast array of special and disaggregated forms of property that could be used in a more radicalized form as instruments for projects of institutional reconstruction. And the second moment of this revised practice of legal analysis, the moment of criticism, works on the internal relation between our interests or ideals and our institutions or our practices. It rethinks the established institutions or practices in the light of professed ideals and recognized interests, and then rethinks the interests or the ideals in the light of the actual or hypothetical institutional experiments. Thus recast as a practice of mapping and criticism, legal analysis becomes in a democracy a sustained conversation about tinkering. Until by dint of talking and acting as motivated tinkerers, we become both realists and prophets. Now this brings me to the third and final part of my argument. The suggestion of how this revised practice of legal analysis might intervene in certain characteristic conflicts of our contemporary political and economic situation. Consider first the debate about the reorganization of firms in the rich economies. There is today a conservative managerial program of industrial renovation. One of its defining tenets is flexibility, meaning freedom for the mobility of capital worldwide. Freedom to reallocate, to close down firms and jobs, to move around, to recombine people and resources. The second defining tenet is the value of cooperation in the workplace, work as teamwork. The central problem of this conservative managerial program is the tension between the commitment to capital mobility and the commitment to cooperation at work, a tension managed by devices such as the segmentation of the labor force. Now there is a second program, the conventional and conservative social democratic program, that seeks to hold back this conservative managerial program of renovation. It wants first to multiply states and stakeholders in productive enterprise, and second, to defend the tenure, the security, not just of individual workers, but of whole segments of the labor force, and in both these ways to limit the mobility of capital. The narrower problem with this program is that it seems to aggravate the complaints of rigidity and of conflict that motivated the conservative program of industrial renovation in the first place. But the broader problem is that it remains complicit in the maintenance of the division within the national economy between vanguard and rearguard. Defending the differential positions of each segment of the labor force in the production system. Now you can therefore imagine a third type of program. Let's call it the radical democratic program. Its central idea is that the market economy should be democratized and workers defended, not by a principle of tenure, not by the importation into the production system of a constitutional regime of checks and balances, but by the multiplication of different forms of access to capital, and by the development of a socially guaranteed set of resources and capabilities, allowing workers constantly to retrain, to move, to reskill, to redevelop. The multiplication of forms of access to capital may begin in modest initiatives of partnership between business and government, but it may also progress toward the formation of social funds or organizations intermediate between the government and the firm. Administering alternative decentralized forms of access to capital. And the principle of the guarantee of the individual worker, although beginning in the mere development of educational opportunities, may develop into the generalization of a principle of social inheritance, replacing family inheritance. A basic social endowment account, which may be increased by two countervailing principles of compensation for certified need on one side or competitive reward for demonstrated capability on the other side. And in all this exercise of the development of the institutional alternatives, the legal institutional details are the crucial element to be produced not by mere invention, by pure fancy, but by the analogical extension of ideological and institutional materials that are already there in our contemporary experience. Now consider finally the debate about the alternatives to the neoliberal political economy around the world. One way to begin this search for alternatives in a real political and economic debate is to look for the beginning of an alternative that's already there. In the contemporary world, people look to the East Asian tigers, to the Northeast Asian political economies, as having at least some measure of difference from the neoliberal formula. What they find is first a form of government-business partnership or strategic coordination that is relatively centralized and collusive. And second, the reliance of this form of collusive partnership between entrepreneurial and political bureaucratic elites upon an authoritarian hard state. A state that is hard in the sense that it is capable of mobilizing resources and formulating and implementing policy with some measure of independence from the economic elites, but that uses the shortcut or the crutch of authoritarianism to achieve its hardness. Now, the question for this democratic critic of neoliberalism would be, could we reinvent the institutional form of this government-business partnership? Could we make it not just more inclusive, but radically more decentralized? Could we change the relation between strategic coordination and market initiative by changing its institutional agents, by creating, for example, entities between the state and the firm, and by introducing alternative sets of property rights, decentralized, fragmentary, conditional, temporary, so that in a market economy, different rules of contract and property come to coexist within the same economic order? The same critic, turning to the authoritarian hard state, would want a democratized hard state. And he might give the following meaning to the concept of a democratized hard state. First, it requires a highly organized civil society, one that has available to it a public law framework, but a framework of institutions independent from the state. Because, this is the general idea, a disorganized society cannot generate alternatives. And the received instruments of corporate and contract law do not suffice for the independent organization of civil society. Second, he would insist on arrangements that heighten and sustain the level of political mobilization in society. Because a politics with a structural content is necessarily a high-energy politics. A de-energized politics is a politics without structural content, a politics of bickering and dealing among the organized interests. Third, he would insist on a style of constitutionalism that favors decisive and repeated practice of structural reform by breaking impasses among branches of government. Because this is the general idea, a set of institutions capable of undermining hierarchy and division is necessarily a set of institutions open to constant challenge and replacement. And finally, he would insist on the development of this social endowment of the individual, this package of basic guarantees and capabilities. Because this is the general idea, democratic experimentalism requires that people be secure and feel secure in a haven of vitally protected interests, and that they have at their disposal the cultural and economic equipment for individual and collective self-determination. The relation of these guarantees and capabilities to the practices of democratic experimentalism is like the relation between the love a parent gives its child and the capacity of the child for self-construction through risk and adventure. My central theme in this talk has been that the progress of democratic experimentalism requires the assistance of the disciplines of the institutional imagination. The institutional and imaginative paths along which democratic experimentalism may develop are contestable and diverse, but they are also particular. Their particularity and their connection back to the here and now through countless steps of transition enable us to imagine them as law and to undertake them as politics. Lawyers have understood law as reason encoded in the dreams and doings of power. Economists have represented market economies and their law as approximations to a pure system of rationality and reciprocity. They have sung for their supper by singing in their chains. Hope and insight may nevertheless succeed where indignation and history worship failed, and draw the lawyers and the economists into the work of giving eyes and wings to the institutional imagination. Our interests and our ideals remain nailed to the cross of our arrangements. We cannot realize our interests and ideals more fully, nor can we understand them more deeply until we learn to reimagine and to remake our arrangements more freely. History will not give us this freedom. We must win it in the here and now of legal detail, economic constraint, and deadening preconception. We shall not win it so long as we continue to profess a science of society, reducing the possible to the actual, and a discourse about law, anointing power with piety. It is true that we cannot be visionaries until we become realists. It is also true that to become realists, we must make ourselves into visionaries.
Roberto Anger, thank you very much. You've provided a rich and memorable Chorley lecture. I can see conversations already developing and lasting late into the evening, and we'll have some more conversations with you tomorrow. Others will have to wait to enjoy this later, when what you have said today appears in the January issue of the Modern Law Review next year. Thank you again very much.